Hello, welcome to today's Dhamma Sutta class with accompaniment from the band next door. Hopefully it does not get too much. For those of you who haven't got your books, please, I have some photocopies here. So please come up. The first 12 who come up, get copies. What was one there? Here we go. Yep. Oops, right. Got lots more photocopies here if anyone else wants one. Very good. Even got some spare ones still. For those of you who got the sheets there, because it's 8 pages, you'll find on the front there, it says 122 Mahasunyata Sutta. You can see actually the last page of this 8-page sutta is on the left-hand side, right at the left of 122. So if you read it, you go to the first page, the second page, third page, fourth page, fifth page, sixth page, seventh page, and the 8th page is on the front. So the first and last pages are next to each other on the front, just in case people get confused. It's 122, Sutta 122. Mahasunyata Sutta. Someone suggested this on Friday night, so... Good Friday or Saturday, we said this. Friday or Saturday. Well, anyway. You can have one. Okay, it's 3 o'clock. So, sutta number 122. Rodney, have you got a book there? Do you want a... Sorry? Okay, you've memorized them all by heart. It's amazing. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So these suttas, again, these are teachings of the Buddha. Some of them are very, very deep. This is one of the deep suttas of the Buddha. And it's... interesting, like many of these suttas, they were prompted by some, not really gross misbehavior, but some lack of proper behavior by some of the monks. And because of that, it stirred up the Buddha to give this beautiful sutta on the discourse on voidness, on sunyata. Sunyata, or voidness, was something which was became an important part of later Buddhism. In Theravada Buddhism, it was still a prominent part of the Dhamma. It was especially almost synonymous with anatta, with the non-self, in that it was emphasizing the emptiness of such a self. Of course, later in Mahayana Buddhism, they started to really get into this emptiness business and said, is emptiness empty? And they got really confused. But this is how the Buddha started to talk about emptiness in the greater discourse on voidness. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in a Sakyan country at Kapalavatthu in Nigrodha's park. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapalavatthu for alms. When he had wandered for alms in Kapalavatthu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went for his day abiding to the dwelling of Kalakemaka, the Sakyan. It's very common here that even though that the monks would be staying in a park under a tree in certain times of the year, or could have been in a hut in that place, in the Nigrodha's park, just outside of Kapalavatthu, they would go for alms round in the city, and they'd either eat it there. Usually there was a hall at the entrance to the city. That was a place where travelers would be able to rest. It was just called the Sabha. And interestingly, the hall at the entrance to the village or the town where travelers would eventually would actually stay, monks would not be able to stay there, but they'd sort of eat there in the morning, like a sort of a communal hall. And that became like a town hall in villages in Europe. And the Sabha is the name of many parliaments in Asia. So I think the Sabha in Delhi, they call their parliament Sabha. All started off as a little hall by the town gate where travelers would be able to rest the night and where monks would be able to eat their meal. Alternatively, they would go out of the town and eat under a tree somewhere. Here we go. And so after the Buddha had gone into Kapalavati for alms, he'd have his meal and then basically look to see where he'd spend the rest of the day. And being a pretty much like a homeless one, he'd sometimes go back to his hut, but other times, if he had some other interesting business, he would go to, in this case, the dwelling of Kalakemaka, the Sakyan, or sometimes just go into the forest and meditate there all day. And most of the time that he wouldn't be talking to any of the monks or the lay people until the evening. They would gather around in the evening and then he would answer questions or give a talk. So the midday was for his daytime abiding. On that occasion, there were many resting places prepared in Kalakemaka, the Sakyan's dwelling. When a blessed one saw this, he thought, there are many resting places prepared in Kalakemaka, the Sakyan's dwelling. Do many monks live there? Now, on that occasion, a Venerable Ananda, along with many other monks, were busy making robes at Gata, the Sakyan's dwelling. Then, when it was evening, the blessed one rose from retreat and went to Gata, the Sakyan's dwelling. There he sat down on a seat made ready and asked the Venerable Ananda, Ananda, there are many resting places prepared in Kalakemaka, the Sakyan's dwellings. Do many monks live there? Venerable Sir, many resting places have been prepared in Kalakemaka, the Sakyan's dwellings. Many monks are living there. This is our time for making robes, Venerable Sir. And this actually times this event very precisely in the Buddhist calendar, because the 1 month at the end of the rains retreat, when all the monks disappear, say, from Dhammaloka, we spend the time in our monastery. The 1 month after the retreat is finished is usually the time when monks would make their robes, mend the old ones, prepare any equipment they needed for further wandering. The rains retreat had finished, the roads were drying out, and it was a time when the monks would go wandering from place to place. So this was a time of tradition where the monks would make their robes, or mend the old ones. Ananda, says the Buddha, and this is obviously a scolding coming. Ananda, a monk does not shine by delighting in company, by taking delight in company, by devoting himself to delight in company, or by delighting in society, by taking delight in society, or by rejoicing in society. Indeed, Ananda, it is not possible that a monk who delights in company takes delight in company and devotes himself to delight in company, who delights in society, takes delight in society, and rejoices in society, will ever obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, and the bliss of enlightenment. But, on the other hand, it can be expected that when a monk lives alone, withdrawn from society, he will obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. Now, many times that when you read these things, sometimes bells ring because some of these phrases you have heard before. And this particular series of blisses, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment, is actually repeated several times, and it is describing a particular thing. Does anyone know what that describes? Jhanas, yes. If you look at the 66th Sutta, for example, where we go? Sutta number 66, page, similar to the quail, that's one of the times, page 55. 557, I think it is. Okay, 557, if those of you have got the books there. Paragraph 20, here Udayan, quite secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters the bodh and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. Paragraph 21, this is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. I serve this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, it should be developed, it should be cultivated, it should not be feared. So here, what the Buddha is very clearly saying is that if you delight in company and society, you will never be able to attain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the bliss of the jhanas, known as the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. Just to mention a few things about those four types of blisses, renunciation is called nekama, means relinquishing, renouncing, and that is the first of the three factors of the second part of the Eightfold Path. The second factor of the Eightfold Path is called Samasankappa in Pali. It's like right thought or right intention, right aspiration. And the first one is Nekama Sankappa, the thoughts, the attitudes, the intentions of renouncing. And this is actually where renouncing leads, so the bliss of renunciation. And you can understand that when you get into a jhana, if you literally renounce, only temporarily, but still you've renounced the whole world of the five senses and the body, and that degree of renunciation is blissful. And as I mentioned many times, the other thing which you've renounced is your will, your controller, and that's bliss. It's also called the bliss of seclusion, viveka, and paviveka, more intense seclusion. And you all know that that seclusion of the body, seclusion of the mind, is important also for deep meditation. You sit in a quiet place. You don't sit in the middle of Hay Street Mall or sit in the center of the market, because there's no seclusion there. It's very hard for allowing the senses to disengage when there's so much happening around you. So you seclude yourself. It's one of the reasons why it's good to close your eyes when you meditate. So you're secluding yourself. You're cutting off the world of sight in reasonably quiet places, so there's not too much noise. In a comfortable position, so there's not so much physical pain, which is like the noise in the ears. Sometimes the physical pain is so great you can't sort of turn it off. So it's a comfortable, peaceful thing you want. That's seclusion. And the bliss of peace have this great word, upasama. I know that our current president saw when he was a novice, that's the name I gave him as a novice, upasamo. It means like, sama means like even, and upasama means like really even, still, calm. Just like if you can imagine like a lake, and it's so even, there's not even a ripple on the surface. And it gives you an idea of what the meaning upasama is. And lastly, the bliss of enlightenment, which I've mentioned on quite a few talks, is quite striking. The Buddha would call the bliss of these jhanas Sambodhi Sukha. And this is now Sambodhi is a word for enlightenment. So this is an accurate translation. And why on earth would the Buddha call these jhanas, which are not enlightenment, the bliss of enlightenment? It's only because they're so close. You're getting a taste of what enlightenment is. The bliss of stillness, the bliss of letting go, the bliss of renunciation. This is like a taste. So he's saying there that if you delight in company, delight in society, you won't be able to get the jhanas. And you can see what he's saying here. Because these monks are all together, they're having a great time sewing robes, and they're probably telling a few jokes with each other and just telling old stories or whatever as they're making their robes together. You can see that this Buddha is saying, look, you'll never get jhana that way. There's a few more people who come in. He don't want a couple of the sheets here of the suttas. Please come in. Last two. Here we go. Okay, it's a book here. Take one of the books as well. There's one that gentleman over there. Do you want to take the book? 1, 2, 2. It's in there somewhere. You can actually take the sheets, and Virginia can have the book, or vice versa. Okay. Good. So we're now on page 972, paragraph 4. And now the Buddha is going on not just to say, not getting the jhanas, but get what comes after the jhanas. Indeed, Ananda, paragraph 4, it is not possible that a monk who delights in company, takes delight in company, devotes himself to delight in company, who delights in society, takes delight in society, rejoices in society, will ever enter upon and abide in either the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. But it can be expected that when a monk lives alone, withdrawn from society, they will enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. Okay, the deliverance of mind which are temporary are again referring to the jhanas, the deliverance of mind which are permanent, unshakable, the inside experiences which make you become one of the Aryas, one of the enlightened ones. So the Buddha is also saying it's not only you can't get into jhanas, but you never get any of the enlightenment states. So the Buddha is actually mentioning there that the monk should live as much as possible secluded, away from society, away from getting involved with too many people. Now, are there any comments or questions on that so far? Yes. Very tough, yeah, on training his monks properly. Yeah. Ajahn Chah, yeah. No, very kind. Sometimes tough, sometimes kind, but mostly just kind. If you're doing the right thing, then you'd always be kind. If you're doing something wrong, that'd be tough. Now, what's not? Yes, it's when you're making the ropes together, it's something you had to do. Remember, there's no sewing machines in those days, so you had to do it by hand. So sewing a monk's robe would take a lot of work. But if you got a few friends to help you out, it would be very, very good and much quicker. But obviously, they were obviously going over the top with this, doing too many. There's too many monks were doing this. And because it was just becoming more like a party, rather than sort of just get the job done and then finish with it, that obviously that it was not being conducive to their deep meditation or to their enlightenment experiences. And you can see that because of that degree of seclusion, that's why we do have our monasteries outside of the city, in the forests, in the bush, where we do have times where we have people coming together for the meal, but then afterwards the monks and nuns disappear. It's in order to try and find the balance between having such seclusion, but also doing our duty, which is a duty for monks and nuns, to teach the lay community. That's why my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, had this brilliant idea of keeping a city center but having two forest monasteries at the same time. So that way that we can come here, and here you have to be in society, and teach as much as you possibly can, but you know I try and get back to my room as soon as possible. And then in Serpentine, that's where we can find seclusion. And that's why if any of you ever do get a bit fed up that you can't access the monks that easily, can't I come in the afternoon at 3 o'clock and have a chat about my problems? Can't I sort of come at sort of 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock and listen to the Dhamma talk for the monks and stuff like that? The reason why is because it's important that the monastic community has seclusion. That they are, we do develop the ability not to delight in company, not to delight in society, and to have individual huts so the monks can, as I mentioned, we try our best to side every hut in such a way that you can't see your neighbour. So for you it looks as if you are in seclusion, away from everywhere. And this is an important point here. The Buddha is saying that without that physical seclusion, without that solitude, you never get these jhanas or never get these enlightenment experiences. It's one of the other reasons why, when designing the retreat center, I want individual rooms for people. If you want to meditate in a group, fine, but it's quiet. But sometimes just being in a room, you can shut the windows, you're alone. There's no one next to you. You can't
can't hear anyone else breathing or getting up and going away. Sometimes that's very important to be able to develop deep meditations. You do need that feeling of solitude, seclusion, to turn off the world and to turn on the mind. Okay. Five. I do not see even a single kind of form, Ananda, from the change and alteration of which there would not arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who lusts for it and takes delight in it. However, Ananda, there is this abiding discovered by the Tathagata, to enter abide in voidness internally, this is sunyata, internally, by giving no attention to all signs. If while the Tathagata is abiding thus, he is visited by monks, nuns, by men or women lay followers, by kings or kings' ministers, by other sectarians or the disciples, then with a mind leaning to seclusion, tending and inclining to seclusion, withdrawn, delighting in renunciation, and altogether done with the things that are the basis for the taints. These are the outflowings. He invariably talks to them in a way concerned with dismissing them. So there's two very deep paragraphs there. First of all, it says, don't see any kind of form, any kind of thing in the external world. Now, the rupa here is the external stuff. I don't see any kind of external stuff, whether it's friendship or whatever, Ananda, from the change and alteration of which there would not arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Even the beautiful stuff, he's saying, is of the nature to end, to pass away. And the more you delight in it, the more you're going to suffer at the end. However, Ananda, he's contrasting this, there is this abiding discovered by the Tathagata to enter abiding voidness internally by giving no attention to all signs. Now that's an abiding of an arahat. It's not an easy thing for non-arahats to do or even to understand. What that is what a person is. You can actually understand that when you look at something, when you hear something, when you even feel something, because you give it a name, because you give it some signature, give it a name, a description, therefore it gives it some existence, some presence. By not attending to any of the signs which define a phenomena, basically the mind is still. It doesn't move into cognition or cognizing, perceiving those objects. So because of that, it's basically the mind is absolutely still. It does not move because it doesn't attend to the signs which make it move. Does that make any sense? That's the abiding of a Buddha. But he says that when people come, out of compassion, he speaks to them. He cannot go into jhanas, because if he went into a jhana samadhi, when people would come, he wouldn't know they're there. Basically, if they did any jhana, whenever he felt like it, kings and ministers would come, people would come, he'd be just sitting there, and he would not be able to know that someone has come, would not be able to speak to them. You've heard me talk about this before. Sometimes you may have seen people in deep meditation. Even in my retreat on Penang, just on the very last day, there was one woman who couldn't get up, couldn't get out, was doing the last ceremonies when you have the photographs and all that stuff done, and she was sitting there having a wonderful time, oblivious to everything. This is just a sign of deep meditation. So you can imagine if a Buddha went into a jhana, really deep jhana, kings and ministers would be sitting there for days, and kings and ministers, whatever, would come, and they wouldn't get any sense from him at all. He'd just be sitting there absolutely still. So that's obviously not a suitable meditation for the Buddha to do when basically he's on the job of teaching. So this is another samadhi which he entered. But, sorry? Yeah? Correct, yeah. We've often... correct, yes. So the samadhi, if he was in a jhana, would not be able to talk to them. So this is not a jhana type samadhi. This is another type of abiding where you can be there, as it were, ready to receive information from the world, but not moving. But not totally apart from the world, which is what happens in the jhanas. So that when the people would come, he could actually start speaking, relate, teach Dhamma, be kind, be helpful. But it's what you pointed out is an important part here, that because that he would not be delighting in society himself, that he would always dismiss them. What do you want to find out? What's the Dharma question? And then get it over and done with, rather than too much chit-chat. Does that make sense? So it's, if any monks ever seem rude to you, because you're talking to them maybe after lunch, and then, I shouldn't tell you my tricks, it works all the time. And down at Serpentine, when people have started to talk, and they're going a bit too long, I just look up at the clock, just once is all you need. And people realize, oh, I must be talking too long. And then they sort of disappear. So, you know, we try and make it useful. Obviously, people want to be able to access the senior monks and learn Dhamma from them to understand some of their kindness. But we don't sort of delight in society and talking for talking's sake. And this is interesting here, where you see the Buddha saying that he invariably talks in a way to dismiss people. Therefore, Ananda, if a monk should wish, may I enter upon and abide in voidness internally, he should steady his mind internally, quiet it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate it. And how does he steady his mind internally, quiet it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate it? So, having described how the Buddha deals with people, by, you know, if he has to speak to them, you can't sort of get into the jhana, you know, if you're going to speak to people, if you're going to do business. So make the mind really, really peaceful by this animita samadhi. Sorry, this signless samadhi, or no, sorry, abiding in voidness. But to be able to do that, you do really need, first of all, to understand what these jhanas are, to strengthen the mind. So this is what he says, steady the mind, quiet it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate it. How is this done? Here, Ananda, paragraph 8, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure nor purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Because the jhanas come up in these suttas again and again and again and again, they're usually abbreviated. But if you see the suttas which aren't abbreviated, it is almost every other page is filled with jhanas. So that is how a monk steadies his mind internally, quiets it, brings it to singleness, and concentrates it. So this is what I mean by quietening the mind. Then he gives attention to voidness internally, just the emptiness of all things. You call it a man or woman, but that's not really a man or a woman there, it's just a sign. You know, you call it old or young, it's just a sign. You know, you call it sort of a floor or ceiling, that's just a sign. You call it sort of yesterday, tomorrow, now. These are just signs. So you just pay no attention to these things. So you discard all these descriptions which classify the world. So he gives attention instead to voidness, the emptiness of all signs. But if his mind does not enter into voidness internally or acquire confidence, steadiness and decision, when that is so, he understands thus. While I'm giving attention to voidness internally, my mind does not enter into voidness internally or acquire confidence, steadiness, and decision. In this way, he has full awareness of that. And this is one of the occasions, this, again, series, which you have here, is Pakandati, he says, enter into, acquire confidence is Sampasadati, steadiness is Santitati, and the next word, decision, in this four groups of terms occurs in the Pali about 80 or 90 times. In the very first time it appears, I think it's in the Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta 64. In the Pali text edition, the person who wrote it down put down Adimuchati. In the back of the Pali Text Society edition, in the notes, he said, I think I made a mistake here. It should have been in Vimuchati, because most of the text said Vimuchati. Only here it says Adimuchati. And it has a completely different meaning. This is in the Pali version, not in the notes here. And I pointed this out to Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he still hasn't changed it yet. But the evidence is incredibly strong. You can't really go for decision. It means the next word should have been released. These are four words which go together all the time. About, I think I counted about 80 or 90 times in the Tripitaka. Mostly in the Anguttara Nikaya. And it's always Vimuchati every time. So obviously this was a typing error. And Bhikkhu Bodhi or rather Venerable Jnana Moli missed that one. The four terms should be, the first one is enter into, but literally means pakandat, means to leap into, to jump into. Now it's a very interesting word. Instead of enter into, it means you're sort of inclining that way so much, you can't hardly stop yourself. You leap into it, you just fall into it, you incline into it, because that's been your inclination for so long. So they say, if your mind doesn't literally leap into it, acquire confidence in it, means joy in it. The confidence and the joy are two words which have pretty much the same Pali word. What you find joy in, you find confidence in. So you leap into it, you have joy and confidence in there, therefore you can have steadiness in there, you're still, you can remain in there. And the last word is the most important. Instead of and decision, it literally means release there. Because decision, it doesn't mean anything. If you look at that English, what on earth does that mean? Enter into voidness, in turn you acquire confidence, steadiness and decision. What does decision mean? So it's actually, that's a mistranslation there. It should, and release, it should be. So now, I've retranslated it. While you're giving attention to voidness internally, your mind does not leap into it. It doesn't find joy in it, steadiness and release in it. The mind's not released from the world by being in there. When that is he understands. While I'm giving attention to voidness internally, my mind does not leap into it, acquire joy, steadiness and release. In this way, he has full awareness of that. He gives attention to voidness externally, to voidness internally and externally. He gives attention to imperturbability. While he's giving attention to each one of these things, his mind does not leap into that thing, joy, steadiness and release. When that is understood, he understands it is so. In that way, he has full awareness of that. So even if it doesn't work, at least he's aware of it. But he should be more than aware of it. Paragraph 10 says, then that monk should steady his mind internally, quiet it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate on the same sign of concentration as before. In other words, after jhana, if you can't get this voidness meditation, then go back into jhanas and strengthen your mind again. So then that monk should steady his mind internally, quiet it, bring it to singleness, and concentrate on that same sign of concentration as before. Then he gives attention to voidness internally. While he's giving attention to voidness internally, his mind does leap into that voidness internally, acquire joy, steadiness, and release. When that is so, he understands thus. While I'm giving attention to voidness internally, my mind does leap into that voidness, acquire confidence, or joy, steadiness, and release. In this way, he has full awareness. With that, he gives attention to voidness externally, voidness internally and externally, attention to imperturbability, while he's giving attention to each one of these things. His mind leaps to that thing, acquires confidence, stillness, and release. When that is so, he understands it is so. Okay, so this is how one, the Buddha, is telling Ananda to gain this this voidness. Obviously, Ananda was also, because of his job of being the Buddha's attendant, would also be meeting many people, and the Buddha was trying to teach him how he can also be with many people to talk to them, but using this meditation on voidness so that he wouldn't get too attracted to the society and the company, which because of his duties he would have to keep. Just pause there before I ask some questions. Again, those four terms, the first one is probably my favorite, because whenever there's many meditators here, when you are meditating in each one of these stages, do you actually find that as soon as you close your eyes, your mind leaps towards meditation? Or do you have to push it? Because sometimes you find that because you push it, it means the mind hasn't had enough good times, joy, happiness there, that as soon as the meditation starts, say, oh great, meditation, at last I can be still, I can get into my deep meditations. That's what I mean by the mind leaping towards it. It's as if it's one of your favorite hangouts in the deep meditation. At last, you've finished with all your jobs. Now you can meditate. Great, let's go. And that's also in many of the stages of meditation. So it's, you know, the breath. At last, the breath is here. As soon as the breath comes up, the mind literally leaps onto it and grabs it, because it's had so many wonderful times there before. And in the deeper meditations, once you get to nimittas, if you know what those nimittas are, you've had lots of experience there, you've really had lots of time and joy there, as soon as a nimitta comes up, bang, the mind goes onto it. It literally leaps onto it. And why does it leap onto it? Because that's where the mind is inclining. It's inclining there because there's lots of experience of those deep states. Pakandatri literally means to jump. It jumps onto these things. So the more you meditate and the more you appreciate the joy and the release of meditation, the more you'll find that the mind will just incline there, will just, as soon as you sit down, you can hardly stop yourself, the mind just goes off into its meditation. And that's a sign the mind is leaping in to the meditation objects. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, carry on. When a monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to walking, he walks, thinking, while I am walking thus, no evil, unwholesome states of covetous and grief will beset me. It's covetous and grief means actually desire and ill will. Again, not a very good translation. Not any wanting or not wanting, no aversion. In this way, he has full awareness of that. And when a monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to standing, he stands. If he wants to sit, he sits. If his mind inclines to lying down, he lies down, thinking that while I'm lying down thus, no evil unwholesome states will beset me. In this way, he has full awareness of that, because your mind is inclined into that voidness without any signs. You can't have fantasies, you can't have dreams, you can't have likes and dislikes, because all likes and dislikes all have to start with some sort of signs, some sort of labels, some sort of designations. At the very least, you know, I like, I don't like, or enemy, friend. But all those labels, designations, signs are all taken away. Basically, nothing can touch you. Now, it might seem easy to do that, and many people try and do that, but they can't. And the reason why is because they got to do the jhanas first, as it says here. This is how the Buddha said you should do this. So the mind is so still and so peaceful, it can actually do that, can actually look at something without giving it any label or sign whatsoever. When a monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to talking, he resolves, such talk as is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and which does not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nirvana. That is, talk of kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food, drink, clothing, beds, gardens, perfumes, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes, streets, wells, the dead, trivialities, the talk of the world. It shouldn't be origin of the world, it's talk of the world, and talk of the sea. Whether things are so or not so, such talk I shall not utter. You can actually add to that these days, sports, scandals, and celebrities. All this talk which most fills most of the magazines and papers. Such talk I shall not utter. In this way, he has full awareness of that. And instead, you just talk about things like disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, upasama again, meditation, knowledge, enlightenment, those things you should talk about. But he resolves, such talk as deals with effacement. Effacement means just the ending of like bad states of mind and bad conduct, as favors the mind's release, and which leads to complete disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, nibbana. That is, talk on wanting little, on contentment, on seclusion, on aloofness from society, arousing energy, virtue, concentration at samadhi, wisdom and deliverance, and knowledge and vision of deliverance. Such talk I shall utter. In this way he has full awareness of that. So the monks always who try and remember, this is what we should really be talking about as much as possible. Talk on wanting little. So as monks, we don't sort of say on what we want. You know, we really, I really do need a better car. I do really need a skateboard. I really do need sort of, you know, a new robe. This robe is a bit old now. You don't talk like that as monks. You talk, this is good enough for me. Just this is enough. Thank you very much. I'm so grateful what we have. And to see how less we can have, not how more we can have. So whenever you look at your hut, you never think, oh, what more can I put in my hut? You always look at how much, how can I get rid of this? Or how can I give this away? Where can I sort of let it go? So it's talk on wanting little. And talk on, what's the other one? On contentment. Now this is good enough. You know, your robes are good enough. Your hut is good enough. The food is good enough. It's all good enough. Contentment and seclusion. Now talk on just being alone, finding a place to be by yourself. If you read that little article in the Enlightened Times when I was last in Singapore, and there's so many people, I tried to get some seclusion, and I went to the toilets in Changi Airport. But even in the toilets, it's hard to get seclusion these days because the toilet attendant recognized me and started asking me questions on the Dhamma. It's very tough being a monk these days. You think at least in the toilets you can find seclusion. So this is what we're supposed to talk about. Any questions on that? Okay, I'll carry on then. Paragraph 13. When a monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to thinking, see, if you're thinking, not talking, you resolve such thoughts as are low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, and which do not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana, that is, thoughts of sensual desire, basically fantasies, thoughts of ill will, when you sort of figure out or you start to plan how you can get your own back on that person who's cheated you or wronged you, thoughts of cruelty, such thoughts I shall not think. In that way he has full awareness of that. And of course that is samasankapa again. Thoughts of sensual desire is wrong sankapa, wrong thoughts, wrong intentions, ill will and cruelty. The opposite of thoughts of sensual desire is thoughts of renunciation. The opposite of thoughts of ill will is thoughts of metta. Thoughts of non-cruelty is actually thoughts of harmlessness. But he resolves, I've got it here, such thoughts as are noble and emancipation and lead the one who practices in accordance with them to the complete destruction of suffering, that is thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, that's metta, and thoughts of non-cruelty, such thoughts I shall think. In this way he has full awareness of that. Carry on. Okay, we're really training the mind here. This is how to become enlightened. Ananda, there are these five cores of sensual pleasure, the five senses. It's just the way they call it, cores of sensual pleasure. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. When it says lust here, it doesn't mean just sensual lust, but anything you like. So you can imagine just your favorite food. You can imagine it now. You always smell it. I don't know if you're hungry, your favorite food. Whatever it is, you can see that that's a form which can be connected with sensual desire, provocative of, you know, I want. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, and tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five causes of sensual pleasure. Herein a monk should constantly review his own mind. Thus, does any mental excitement, really should be mental behavior, mental excitement is not such a bad word in one sense because it means that the mind is sort of starting to get active. Concerning this five cause of sensual pleasure, ever arise in me on any occasion. If on reviewing his mind the bhikkhu understands mental excitement or concerning this five cause of sensual pleasure does arise in me on certain occasion, then he understands desire and lust for these things are unabandoned in me. And this way he has full awareness of that. But if on reviewing his mind the bhikkhu understands no mental excitement concerning this five cause of sensual pleasures arises in me on any occasion, then he understands desire and lust for the five cause of sensual pleasure are abandoned in me. In this way he has full awareness of that. And that's like an anagami or arahat. Ananda, there are these five khandhas, or five aggregates affected by clinging.
in regard to which a monk should abide, contemplating rise and fall thus. Such is material form, such its arising, such its disappearance, such is feeling, such its arising, such its disappearance. Such is perception, such is arising, such is disappearance. Such are formations, one of which is will. Such their arising, such their disappearance, and such is consciousness, the one which knows, or that which knows. Such is arising, such the disappearance of the knowing. When he abides contemplating rise and disappearance, I've got that four crossed out there, disappearance is the correct word, in these five aggregates affected by clinging, the conceit, I am, based on his five aggregates affected by clinging, is abandoned in him. When that is so, the monk understands the conceit, I am, based on his five aggregates affected by clinging, is abandoned in me. In that way, he has full awareness of that. When it says the conceit, it doesn't mean the English word of conceit. It means like a conceiving, a thought, a way of looking. So usually the word conceit means like pride, but this is just like a conceiving, just an idea, the idea, you might say. I am, it completely disappears. And because you contemplate the rise and disappearance of these things, it's because not just a fall and then arise straight away afterwards, it's the arising, what causes these things. When it says the rising, it's in the Nidana Sanyutta, they actually start to talk about what it means by the rise and the fall. Well, the rise and the fall, what it really means is that the cause of these things, where does like form come from? Now, where does feelings come from? Where does perception, where does consciousness come from? And actually in the Nidana Sanyutta, for example, with consciousness, it says the cause of consciousness is nama rupa. You need like an object of consciousness, something to be conscious of. And with the arising of nama rupa, when there's something to be conscious of, then there can be consciousness. When there is nothing to be conscious of, then consciousness ceases. Simple thing like that. So this is what it means by the rise. It doesn't mean seeing them come out of nothing. It's seeing why they come. Seeing they're a causal process. And seeing when the cause is taken away, then the effect also falls away or disappears. Now that is actually why the rise and fall of these things, or the rise and disappearance, the causes and their ending. This is actually where we see that if this thing called rupa, form, is caused by things, and when the cause disappears, that ends. This cannot be me. It cannot be a permanent self. It cannot be an essence. You see Vedana, where Vedana, this pleasure and pain, come from. You see where it's caused. You see when the causes disappear, the effect disappears. This cannot be me. Perceptions, the fourth kanda, important sankharas, especially will, that's the most prominent of the fourth kanda, the fourth aggregate. You see, what causes will? That's seeing its rise. Where does it come from? And I've given many talks about that, just how much we're conditioned and brainwashed. And you can see when those causes disappear, so does the will disappear. And that's one of the great, I keep on saying, that's one of the great insights of second jhana and above, to see the will completely vanish, because its causes have gone. As you see, it's ending. And then it's very, very unlikely that anyone can ever think that they are the one who decides ever again. And lastly, the vijnana, the knowing, consciousness, mind. To actually to see, where does that come from? To see its cause. That's what it means by its rise. And I already mentioned that, nama rupa. And where... when nama rupa disappears, then so does mind, knowing, consciousness go. So because of observing these, that is why we can never say, I am any one of these things. And there's nothing left actually to build up an I am anything. If you're not form, if you're not pleasure, pain, if you're not will, the doing, if you're not knowing, it doesn't make any sense to call yourself anything.
you've seen anatta, no self. You do not exist. But don't tell your psychologist that, otherwise you get sent to Greyland. I am not. So, any questions about that? Yeah. I think it's name and form, I think. So, mentality, materiality, could do that, but you have to be careful there, because there's often a big debate between monks about the meaning of that. Ajahn Sujata just told me that he was at a conference and he gave the standard definition of Namarupa, and the Tibetan monk came like, it's not that at all. And what's actually happened there is that the original meaning of Namarupa is very clear from the suttas. Ajahn Sujata was right here, that the Namarupa is a name and form, the objects of consciousness, if you like. If consciousness is a knowing, then what you know is Namarupa. Rupa is the physical things, Nama is the mental things, like mentality, materiality, you know, what the mind can know. However, the Abhidharma started messing around and giving it further definitions, and Nama actually included knowing. Not just what you can know, but the knowing process itself. And it got very confused, and then the commentaries took that up. And the Tibetan Buddhism was actually a much later form of Buddhism, and it took into account all these later developments, and it got very confused. And it wasn't as clear as the original teachings of the Buddha. So that's why if you start talking about Namarupa, you have to get your books out and say, look, this is how it meant originally. I understand what you meant. You're defining its meaning later on in the word's development. It's like you argue with a person, what does the word gay mean? And if you look at the word gay 100 years ago, it has a completely different meaning than it has today. So in this case, Namarupa, we always use the original meaning as said by the Buddha, which has a different meaning than it was used, say, 1,000 years later. But this is what Namarupa really means, is name and form, objects of consciousness, what your mind can know. Is that quite clear? Yeah. Oh, it is, yes. But there is a way of controlling your thoughts, but the thing is, you can't control your thoughts by just saying, I shall not think, and using will. You start with that determination that this is my goal, I shall stop these bad thoughts, but then you've got to find out the way to do that, which sometimes takes many, many years. But it has to start with the aspiration. So I want to sort of stop, you know, thinking like these cruel thoughts to Ainsley or whatever else it is. Once you have the aspiration there, then now how can I do this? What you're saying is quite true. You can't just do it an act of will. Right, I'm going to stop thinking this way from now on. No more can you say, right, I'm going to stop, say, smoking cigarettes. It's not that easy because it's a habit. So you have to use all these wonderful training techniques, you know, in Buddhism, like meditation, like mindfulness, like resolutions, like, you know, the four right efforts, trying to fill the mind with wholesome things, so the unwholesome things just can't get a foot in the doorway. So positive thinking, instead of thinking the negative thoughts, enjoy the positive ones. Instead of thinking low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial thoughts, you know, you develop these other ones, you appreciate them, just see how wonderful they are, to think, you know, amazing, beautiful, kind, positive thoughts, until it becomes a habit. So it's true, it's a good, what you know to do is very good. You can't just say, I'm going to stop thinking these things. But you have to begin that way. Say, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Now, how do we manage that? Any other questions there? Okay, let's go forward. Okay, we just talked about how to abandon the conceit I am. So this is actually a very, very deep sutta. It goes right to the end of the practice, arahat. Because when the conceit I am is abandoned, then you are a full arahat. 18. These states have an entirely wholesome set of basis here. Consequence, I have written down here, is much better. Much better translation. In other words, all these things, they always lead to something which is always really wonderful. They are noble, super mundane, inaccessible to the evil one. That's Mara. They have this idea in Buddhism. It is a being, but it's also used as a metaphor of Mara, so the tempter. Basically, and it's, I mentioned this point, it's a wonderful metaphor in traditional Buddhism, Mara, the evil one. Mara, the evil one, is the head of this plane of existence called the Parinimitta Vasavati realm, the realm of beings who wield power over others. This is the guy who wields power. He's a control freak. So in modern parlance, you call Mara the control freak in chief. Now, I always mention that because it's Mara, that's the realm he exists in, the realm where people really get off on power and controlling others. And you can understand just why that saying by Lord Acton, if power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely, power controlling does corrupt. And it corrupts you in your mind as well if you try and control it. These are states beyond control. Therefore, they're away beyond the power of controlling, of will, of doing. So, stop being a control freak. If you are, you are in the hands of Mara. What do you think, Ananda? What good does a disciple see that he should seek the teacher's company even if he's told to go away? Now, I always say about not keeping company with people, but now he's saying about keeping company with the Buddha. So what do you think, Ananda? What good does a disciple see that he should seek the teacher's company even if he's told to go away? And Ananda was very smart here because instead of getting himself into trouble by giving a wrong answer, he said, Venerable Sirs, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One. Guided by the Blessed One, have the Blessed One as their resort. It would be good if the Blessed One would explain the meaning of these words, having heard it from the Blessed One, because we'll remember it. So that especially sometimes when you have a teacher like that, just to say, well, you know, you're the teacher. You should ask me a question. I'll ask you the questions, basically. Ananda. A disciple should not seek the teacher's company for the sake of discourses, stanzas, and expositions. Why is that? For a long time, Ananda, you have learned the teachings, remembered them, recited them verbally, examined them with the mind, and penetrated them well by view. But such talk as deals with effacement, as favors the mind's release, and which leads to complete disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nirvana, that is talk on wanting little, on contentment, seclusion, aloofness from society, arousing energy, virtue, samadhi, wisdom, deliverance, knowledge and vision of deliverance. For the sake of such a talk, a disciple should seek the teacher's company, even if he is told to go away. That's okay. So the reason you're coming here is not just to listen to another sutta discourse, not to get some more wisdom about Buddhism so you can get a degree and a PhD and become a doctor of Buddhism. It's not just so that you know more than the person sitting next to you. The perfect reason why you should seek a teacher's company is not just for the sake of listening for listening's sake, but to hear talks which deal with effacement, favors of mind's release, which leads to disenchantment from the world, dispassion, leads to cessation, the ending of things, peace, jhanas, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. Now, all these things I should mention, there's a sequence there. From disenchantment, dispassion is sometimes called fading away. When you get disenchanted, disengaging from things, then you get sort of things fade away, then they cease. In the cease is this beautiful peace. And from the peace, you get the knowledge. And from the knowledge, you get enlightenment. And from enlightenment, you get full cessation, nibbana. This is what causes those things, just wanting little. On contentment, even in meditation. Don't be someone who wants jhana, second jhana, third jhana, enlightenment, all these wisdoms. Be someone who's content, who wants little, That's the way to get to jhanas. Seclusion, aloofness from society, arousing energy, virtue, samadhi, wisdom. That's why you should seek the teacher's company. And even if you're told to go away, keep on seeking the teacher's company for things like that. Since this is so, Ananda, a teacher's undoing may come about, a pupil's undoing may come about, and the undoing of one who lives a holy life may come about. And so how does a teacher's undoing come about? Here, some teacher resorts to a secluded resting place, a forest, a root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside, cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. That's a standard list of secluded places. While he lives thus withdrawn, Brahmins and householders from town and country visit him. And as a result, he goes astray, becomes filled with desire, succumbs to craving, and reverts to luxury. The teacher is said to be undone by the teacher's undoing. He has been struck down by evil and unwholesome states that defile, bring renewal of being, that's reincarnation, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging and death. This is how the teacher's undoing comes about. How does a pupil's undoing come about? A pupil of the teacher, emulating the teacher's seclusion, resorts to a secluded resting place, in the secluded places. While he lives thus withdrawn, Brahmins and householders from town and country visit him, and as a result he goes astray, becomes filled with desire, succumbs to craving, and reverts to luxury. The pupil is said to be undone by the pupil's undoing. He has been struck down by evil, unwholesome states that defile being, renewal of being, give trouble, ripen in suffering, and lead to future birth, aging, and death. This is how the pupil's undoing comes about. It's a great line there, because you see this happening. It's great that you all understand this and look after your monks and nuns, because it's happened so often that the monks and nuns, they go off to secluded places and they practice well, live in simplicity, and people get lots of faith in them. Wow, look at those, they work so hard, they just meditate, they live so simply, and so more people go and visit those monks. And because they visit those monks, you give those monks more business and more duties, and they become wealthy, and then they become slack, and they've lost it. This is what happens to the forest tradition in Thailand, in my lifetime even. The forest tradition, when it first started, no one was interested in the forest monks. They were a bit crazy, and they didn't know all the chanting, and they weren't as popular as the monks who lived in the towns and the cities. So all the monks in the towns and the cities, they get invited to this dana and that sort of ceremony. And that was great, because the forest monks could be left alone to meditate. But then after a while, the people started complaining about the city monks. They weren't keeping the rules properly. They were handling money and having lots of stuff. And so they said, oh, these forest monks, they live so simply and they're so peaceful. It doesn't matter if they can't chant properly. These are the pure monks. So they started going to the forest monasteries and giving all these huge donations and building these amazing halls and inviting all these monks to their dhanas and celebrations, their weddings and funerals. And so the forest monks ended up sort of, you know, with all of the Rolex watches and the big stuff. So you can see the nature of what happens, and this is the teacher's undoing, the pupil's undoing. That's why the Buddha said, if you are becoming a famous monk, and I have to be careful of this, there's three things you have to be very careful of: labha, sakara, siloka. Labha is your gains, because when you become famous, people want to give you things. So this is why it's great we keep the rules that the monks don't have any money. It all goes into the kitty, which is run by the Buddha Society. So I don't have any gains. And sakara, siloka is the praise and fame. And the Buddha said, that is very, very dangerous. You should also be very careful of that. And in my position, I've told all my monks, I tell you, if you see me getting too caught up in your own gains and fames and praise, then please let me know. Give me the kick up the backside. The monks say, look after me. Make sure that, because everyone thinks, oh yeah, I'm above this, I'm not going to get famous, or I can handle it. But what was it that Venerable Dhammika once said? If you go to the United States and when you come back you have to insist on someone carrying your baggage, then you've lost it. So make sure that, you know, you keep simple. And so, you know, make sure that your monks and your nuns keep it simple. When you come to our monasteries on the Katina days or the in my monastery, the range retreat, entry day, the continual days, go into people's huts, go into my hut, and make sure that it's not more luxurious than it was the year before. Because if it is, then you say, oh, this is a part of danger. You're becoming sort of more caught up in luxury and possessions. It's very easy to do that. But I think you also know that one of the most inspiring occasions was when Najan Chah asked me to go up and see his hut. And just to get something there. And he was at the height of his fame and his power at this time. He had nothing in there. This great monk. He could have whatever he wanted. Just it was a mat, a robe, and a book. That was it. In this great monk's room. That's all the possessions he had. And his bowl. I think his bowl was actually with one of the novices. And that's what you call like a real monk. So if you see any monks are getting too much possessions, too much stuff, you know, just, we're losing it. This is why the Buddha says over here, it's the undoing of a teacher. They start to be in seclusion, living very simply. But because you live so simply, you get visited by Brahmins and householders from town and country. And you've got to be very careful that it doesn't lead you astray when they give you too many things. And how does the undoing of one who lives a holy life comes about? Here, a Buddha, Tathagata, appears in the world. Oh, so anyone want to make any comments about that, first of all? So please look after your monks. Don't give them too much. If you want to do any donations, Buddhist society, never to monks or nuns. Just so they've got enough to eat, and that's all. Enough robes. If you see them wearing lame robes, they've lost it. So we still, I've got patches on my robes and I still try and keep those patches. How does the undoing of one who lives a holy life come about? Here a Tathagata, a Buddha, appears in the world accomplished and fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds. What does that mean, knower of the worlds? Anyone know what knower of the worlds means? There are three worlds, Tiloka. Who knows what the three worlds are? The three worlds are Karmaloka, the world of the five senses. Basically, this human realm plus ghost realms, hell realms, some of the lower heavenly realms. So this is only a fraction of the Karmaloka, what you know. But if you know the ghost realms and the realms of the devas, then you know much more of this world. And there's two other worlds, yet you don't know. And the second world is Rupa Loka, it's the Jhana realms. And the third realm is the Arupa Loka, the formless realms, the immaterial attainment realms. So that's why the Buddha calls himself knower of the worlds. Incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He resorts to a secluded resting place, a forest, a heap of straw. While he lives thus withdrawn, Brahmins and householders from town and country visit him, yet he does not go astray or become filled with desires that come to craving and revert to luxury. Because he's a Tathagata. He doesn't get astray or become filled with desires that come to craving and revert to luxury. Not every person who becomes visited or famous goes astray. But a disciple of this teacher, emulating this teacher's seclusion, resorts to a secluded resting place. While he lives thus withdrawn, Brahmins and householders from town and country visit them, and as a result they go astray, become filled with desire, succumb to craving, revert to luxury. This one who lives a holy life is said to be undone by the undoing of one who lives a holy life. He has been struck down by evil, unwholesome states that defile, being renewal of being, gives trouble, ripening suffering, and lead to future birth and aging and death. Thus there comes to be the undoing of one who leads a holy life. And herein, Ananda, the undoing of one who leads a holy life has a more painful result, a more bitter result than the teacher's undoing or the pupil's undoing. And it may even lead to perdition, to hell. So this is disciple of the Buddha. So he's saying if it's just an ordinary teacher or the pupil of an ordinary teacher, but if it's a pupil of the Buddha, that's even worse. Therefore, Ananda, behave towards me with friendliness, not with hostility.
that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. And how do disciples behave towards their teacher? With hostility, not with friendliness. Hereinunder, compassionate and seeking their welfare, the teacher teaches the Dharma to the disciples out of compassion. This is for your welfare. This is for your happiness. But the disciples do not want to hear that or give ear. They set their minds on something else. That was actually missed out here. His disciples do not want to hear or give ear. They set their minds on something else. They do not exert their minds to understand. You know what it's like when you don't want to listen to somebody? You start thinking about something else. They err and turn aside from the teacher's dispensation. Thus do disciples behave towards the teacher with hostility, not with friendliness. And how do disciples behave towards the teacher? With friendliness and not with hostility. Here and under compassion and seeking their welfare, the teacher teaches the Dharma to the disciples out of compassion. This is for your welfare, this is for your happiness. His disciples want to hear and give ear, and they don't set their minds on something else. Instead, they exert their minds to understand. They do not err and turn aside from the teacher's dispensations. Thus, the disciples behave towards the teacher with friendliness, not with hostility. Therefore, Ananda, behave towards me with friendliness, not with hostility. This will lead you to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Because he's just been scolding Ananda. I shall not treat you as a potter treats the raw damp clay. Repeatedly admonishing you, I shall speak to you, Ananda. Repeatedly admonishing you, I shall speak to you, Ananda. The sound core will stand the test. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that was the Mahasunyata Sutta. It was very deep. It was telling about how the Buddha dealt with his fame and how all his people visiting him. How sometimes that he would just dismiss them, the way he used his voice, the way he used his speech. When he wasn't being visited, he'd have this void deliverance of mind. If you want to get that void deliverance of mind, it has to be based on jhanas. So the mind leaps to that voidness, the voidness of all signs, distinctions in people and things. So that way you're not inclining to the wrong talk or wrong thought, but instead you're inclining with speech and thought to talk such as on effacement, favoring the mind's release, such as dispassion, cessation, peace, nibbana, and talking on wanting little, aloofness, arousing energy, virtue, concentration, wisdom, deliverance, understanding that you keep checking yourself. If you really want to get to become enlightened about what the five senses are, the five sense pleasures, and make sure they're not really controlling you, and that you understand the five aggregates, the five khandhas, and realizing by noticing where they come from, their cause, and where they disappear, that they cannot be an essential self. So the conceit of I am anything or anywhere is completely abandoned. And that way you become an arahat, and you should only seek the teacher's company, not just for wasting time by learning things, but just to learn enough so that it favors the mind's release, which leads to disenchantment, to nibbana. And lastly, saying how the teachers and the pupils' undoing comes about, because that when you are practicing with a good mind at the beginning, you really want to be aloof, alone, secluded. Then, because of the nature of things, you become popular. People like to visit you, but be careful that you don't take too many things. You don't give rise to fill with desires to come to craving and revert to luxury. Even though you are given things, give them away again. And that way you're not undone by the teachers and pupils undoing. And the Buddha was saying that even though it might be a tough teaching for you, because you've only been making robes, this is what you're supposed to be doing. But nevertheless, the Buddha saw a small fault there, a small danger. So please, Ananda, don't look upon me with hostility. Listen to what I'm saying. I've only got your welfare and happiness at heart. So behave towards me with friendliness. And that's the teaching of the Mahasunyata Sutta. Any questions on that? Deep Sutta. Yes.
not to be an arahat to get into voidness, but it certainly would help, but certainly have to know the jhanas to get into such voidness. Otherwise, you know, it's very easy for sometimes some people to think that, you know, they're looking at things which are void, but the mind is not still enough, and the mind's tendencies to want to be averse, to get rid of things, the five hindrances, will be what blocks you from gaining that internal voidness, sunyata. It's the hindrances which control the mind. The Buddha said that's the food for delusion, the hindrances. So the only way that you can gain such an amazing samadhi, a sustained attention, a stillness, which the Buddha used, instead of actually getting into the jhanas, which would make him completely inaccessible to visitors, to get this this type of samadhi of voidness, would be actually to be able to completely let go of all distinctions, all sort of names, signs, signatures, labels. People think they can do that, but it's too hard, because the hindrances will still be active. But after the jhanas, that's when the hindrances have been suppressed. It says in the Nalakapana Sutta that when the meditator has been into a jhana, the five hindrances do not invade the mind nor remain. So that's the job of the jhanas there. That's why the Buddha put the jhanas in that sutta, to say, do this first, and then you'll find that you could access that state of no labeling, voidness, not attention to any signs. And if you do that and the mind doesn't leap towards that state, you've got to go back into the jhanas and smash those or suppress those hindrances again. So are you all bamboozled, inspired, or what? Inspired, that's very good. Any other questions? Yeah, John. More subtle layers of energy, yeah, but mind energy. These are mind worlds more than anything else. And this is, I don't know, I think I gave this talk here a few weeks ago. When I was in the United States, one of the things which the people were talking about were intelligent design. You know, the fundamentalist Christians were going bananas over there with intelligent design. And so you had to, what was the Buddhist explanation? And so quite a few talks I've been giving on this. And who created the world? The answer is, you create the world. The mind creates the world. That's basic quantum physics. The mind creates when it observes. It literally sort of collapses the Schrodinger equation and gives you an event. Without that, there's just a mass of probabilities, a smear of nothingness, that you are smeared over the whole universe until I observe you and then give you a meaning. That's quantum physics, basically. So, you do create the world. The mind does do that. That's basic science. So, when Buddhism, we've always known the mind is a forerunner, is a chief. So we're looking for all the different worlds, and not the worlds of, you know, planets and solar systems, that's physical stuff. We're talking about the mind levels. This is what we mean by the worlds, what the mind creates. So to know the whole extent of what the mind can create, then you know the three levels of world. Yes. No, the thinking is just a process of thoughts coming and going. But so I think what you're trying to point to is, what's the cause of thoughts? And we create those thoughts. A lot of time it's because of discontent, because of a lack of contentment, we think. When you get more content in the moment, when you don't want anything, then you are undermining the thinking process. In the contentment of deep meditation, the thoughts don't come. I know that sometimes in meditation, sometimes people would say, oh, the thoughts came by themselves. I said, rubbish, the thoughts didn't come by themselves. You went outside and dragged them in. That's basically what happened. Because they can't come by themselves. You make them come. If you actually see that whole process, you're just a little bit bored and disinterested. And so a lot of times you just almost, you may not be able to see it. And maybe at that time subconscious to you. You just go through your whole retinue, your whole filing cabinet of things to think about. And just go and pick one out. Just something to do, that's all. Like just kids, just what's on the TV today? Just surf the channels, is that right? That's what you do, you surf your inventory of things to think about. And then the thought comes, but you actually invited that thought in. Because if you were really still and peaceful, no thoughts come in at all. So that's, is that what you're really asking about the course of thoughts? Yeah. But actually, you actually see later on in meditation, you invite them in there, basically. So, because that's why, if that was the case, there would be no possibility of ending all thoughts. But because you bring them in, you can actually just cut off that. You don't put like a guard and put a stop sign on. You just cut off that which keeps inviting the thoughts in, which is basically discontent. From discontentment, we move the mind. Yes, Joel. Has your mind moved again? Has your mind moved? Why do we come back again? Because you want to. Yeah, delusion, stupidity, basically. It's true. Okay, I'm putting it sort of quite grossly. But it is delusion, because we think next time we'll make it better. Now I'm more wise and more sharp. Next time I'll do it right. And you think the next time it will be right. Is that old story, this was mentioning Ajahn Chakra earlier. One of his old famous stories about this Sufi Mullah Nasruddin, who was sitting down there eating all the hot chili peppers. And he's eating one after the other, after the other, after the other. And when his friend saw him, he was, you know what happens when you eat chili, your nose is running, your eyes are all streaming with tears, and your face is all red. What are you doing that for? Said his friends. I'm looking for the sweet one, said Nasruddin. So why do we get reborn? It's the same reason why Nasruddin was eating another chili. Because we're looking for the sweet one. Not really. But all those chilies, they're all hot. Isn't that such thing as a sweet one? Ajahn Chah, the way he put it, we're looking for the tortoise with the moustache. That's why we keep getting reborn. You're looking for something which doesn't exist. So you keep on looking and looking and looking and looking and looking and looking. More and more rebirth until you finally figure out that a tortoise with a moustache does not exist. That all chilies are hot. The five khandhas are suffering. And there's not any form. It was what the Buddha said here. And the change of which will not make you cry. Once you realize that, you think, what am I doing this for? Okay. So you got reborn this time, Joel. Don't do it again. Yeah? Yeah. Correct, yeah. No, you can't burn off karma. It's just too much. It's like burning off all the wood in the world. All the forest is like sort of dry. draining all the seas. You can't sort of burn off karma. You can just move to a position where the karma can't reach you anymore. This is actually what we do. So trying to work out all the bad karma. You've got so much. You've got heaps, mountains of good karma. And you've got mountains of bad karma. You can never use up all your good karma. You've got so much of it. Nor can you burn off all your bad karma. Because every bit of karma you make, if you do some bad karma, the result is multiplied thousandfold, like the simile of a mango. One mango planted in the ground creates thousands of mangoes. So, you know, when you do an act of, like, karma, bad karma, you don't just get... It's not an eye for an eye. It's like, you know, thousands of eyes for one eye you take. If you make an act of kindness, you may give a donation. You don't get it, you know, you give a $10 donation, you get $10 back. You get thousands of dollars back. It's like always multiplied. So all those acts of good karma and bad karma you've done, they just get multiplied so much. So everyone here has got heaps of good karma. Sometimes you just can't access it. And they've got heaps of bad karma, and it's a good job you don't access it. So the point is that because you've got so much, there's always a possibility of some bad karma from somewhere in the past can actually come up. It's almost just infinite in its mass. But you move to places where those bad karmas just can't come. So this is the whole point of enlightenment, getting out of samsara. And that way, karma is ended. Not just ending the bad karma and keeping the good stuff, because you can't have one without the other. You just end both of them. Okay, going, gone. Okay, 4:30. Before we finish off here, has anyone got any suggestions for what you want for in 2 weeks' time? It's amazing. Last year I was away for so many of these sutta classes. But even though I'm going to be away next Sunday, I'll be in Thailand hanging out with my mates in Wat Nanachat, like Ajahn Yan, Sumedho. But I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. So there's another sutta class in 2 weeks' time. Any suggestions? Short one on dependent. Is there a short one on dependent origination here? There is. There's a long one. What's it called? The Samaditi Sutta. That's a long one. I don't know if there's a short one in here. But anyway, what have you got, Joel? Number 9. That is Samaditi Sutta. Do you want number 9 next week? It is. It's quite a long one. But it's on the dependent origination. It's a very powerful one, the Four Noble Truths. If you have no other suggestions, it's going to be number 9. Going. Yes, John. Sotapanna Sanyutta. Actually, if you want to do a Sotapanna, the Kosambiya Sutta is a good one in here. What is that one? Kosambiya Sutta. That's one of my favorite ones. So, 48. Let's do number 48 next week, because that's... I haven't done that for a while. It's not just a long one. Yeah, let's do number 48 next week. Are you okay with that? 48, Kosambiya Sutta. It's about these monks who had this big argument and almost split the Sangha. It talks about loving kindness and about using things in common and about being a stream winner. Hi, this is a great one. But do you want that one or number 9?
Going.
Now, it's the Samaditi Sutta, right view. It's all about dependent origination. Let's do dependent origination first, and then afterwards we'll do number 48. Reason, John, that I didn't want to do too many from the Sangyutta, that people haven't got those books. So So they got the Majjhima Nikaya. So how many people here have got the Saguta? There's only 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, we'll keep the Majjhima for the time being anyway. Okay, so next week is 2 weeks' time, 9. And that will be followed by 48. Okay. So now pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can get ready to go.
Arahan Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadebi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.